Hello and welcome to the Blues Guitar Show podcast with me, Ben Martin, from thebluesguitarshow.com, the podcast that brings you passion, practice and perseverance for your guitar playing journey. I hope everyone is having a great week this week and enjoys this extra little episode that we've got for today. Extra special one today, I'm talking to Casper Berry-Rapkin, who is a fantastic guitarist and absolutely brilliant slide player. And we get into all sorts of things. We talk about the state of the music industry, what it's like being an artist in 2023, what it's like coming up as a guitar player. Really, Casper is on the kind of the up and up of his career, which is really cool. It's great to speak to somebody who's kind of at that stage where they're just about to take off, and I really think that this guy is going to. He just played on number one record in the blues chart, which was with The Curse of KK Hammond. I'm going to link to some of this stuff below, but if you want to check out KK Hammond's stuff, the stuff that she's done with Casper, and all kinds of other good stuff, I'll link to his music as well. But yeah, enjoy my interview with Casper. Cheers to Casper for coming on. It was great to chat to him. He was not feeling his best, but like an absolute trooper, he still stuck through and and we got the whole way through. So enjoy. All right, so I am on with Casper Berry-Rapkin. How are you doing, sir?
I'm okay. I've been better. It could always be worse. I'm talking to you right now from my dad's attic in my dressing gown, in my pajamas, man.
There you go.
It's typical Wednesday night for me. Oh, I'm sick. I was supposed to go masking today.
To be fair, I expected you to sound worse. So.
I was pretty bad this morning. As I said to you, I might come on here sounding like Alan Wolf or something, but we're all good now.
You could have done an impression for like the first half hour.
That could have been good. That could have been misleading.
Nice, man. So, really good to talk to you and great to meet you. One of the things that's really cool about this is that I get to talk to players that I admire. I've been admiring your stuff on Instagram particularly for quite a long time, but you've had quite a big few months, really. I rewatched today the video of not In the Pines, but what is it?
Heart-shaped box.
That's the one. I rewatched the Heart-shaped box video with The Curse of KK Hammond. If anyone hasn't seen that, do go and watch it. I'm going to link to it in the show notes below. It's like, it's like epic of Lord of the Rings type proportions kind of music video. Could you just talk a little bit about that?
Oh, man. I was. That's been a long time coming, and I'm kind of glad it's done and out of the way, but at the same time it's out. And as you saw today, like, you know, the not repercussions, but the effect of it is lasting still. So I was over at KK Hammond's house one evening, and we were chilling out as we do, and she said, oh, should we film a little cover? We've not done that before. I said, okay, yeah, that sounds cool. I'll play banjo. And we were kind of talking like, oh, what can we blues up that's like a rock song already? And we thought, oh, Heart-shaped box is kind of three chords. We'll just throw it together. And we kind of threw together this video. It didn't really get much traction. And then a week later or so, suddenly we opened TikTok and it's like got a million views or something like that. And we were like, oh, okay. And you know how in TikTok and Reels, you can use sounds, quote unquote sounds. So people were using the sound for all their weird things. And one community that's like the sound is the taxidermy community. And in fact, here's one KK made me.
Oh, wow. Okay, for people who can't see, there's a skull.
There's a deer skull, yeah.
Deer skull, right?
And I'm just hitting my mic stand. But people were using the video and then they said, oh, where's the full cover? And we were like, oh, maybe we should make a full cover. And again, we were like, oh, yeah, it's just banjos, guitar. 10 months, multiple mixing sessions at Abbey Road, guitar solos, staying up till like 4 a.m. trying to get the right take. The banjo part was a nightmare, but we got there. And then we said, okay, now we should do an epic video for it. And we rounded up some of my homies and some of KK Hammond's homies and got it together, man. It was really fun.
And it got to number one, right?
Yes. We got to number one on the blues charts for UK and US, and we got to 131 on the mainstream charts, right between, who was it? It was Duran Duran and Taylor Swift. I was like, oh man, if we could beat Taylor Swift, that'd be a milestone for me anyway.
And if you can get higher than her in the charts, even better.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, man. That was a crazy month or so.
Mm.
Yeah.
There's a couple of things you kind of skimmed over there. We'll talk about a little bit more. Firstly, mm-hmm. you're a multi-instrumentalist. And I mean, I guess, would you describe yourself as you're like a musician, band leader? You also do street musician stuff. You lead a band, right?
Yeah, I wear so many hats, dude. And, you know, this is something I'm hoping we can get into today about musicians, you know, needing to wear so many hats these days in order to, you know, try and do. I mean, you yourself, you were saying earlier, oh, I'm just a musician. I don't want to be a journalist. But here we are. You end up in these situations where it's like, okay, yeah, sure, I'll take this opportunity. And then it just snowballs into something else. But ultimately, I'm a guitar player. I do solo gigs. I do gigs with my band. And then I dabble in other projects as well. I also do a bit of event promotion, a bit of teaching. And recently, yeah, I started busking. Gigs are quiet. So I went out into St. Albans, started busking.
Busking's great, though. I mean, I was listening to, you know, the guitarist Corey Wong.
Yeah.
The podcast, and he was talking to a guy who was a jazz bass player. He's an upright jazz bass player. And he decided he really wanted to get good. So he just went out and started busking in the Netherlands and just spent 5 years just working the streets. And he said, basically, you know, he got together with a couple of other guys, a couple of local guys. And he said that, you know, he'd never seen chops like it. You know, if you want to make actual money busking, you've got to have serious chops. And it's just a great way of, I mean, especially if the weather's nice. I mean, not now. Now it's cool. If the weather's nice, like if you're going to practice for 3 or 4 hours, you know, go out and do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I find every time I do decide to go busking, which usually happens once a year for about a month, I always find a new way to make people's heads turn, which is really handy in gigs. And, you know, when you're generally playing or like you kind of do some licks or maybe a certain song that makes people go, huh? Because usually you get ignored. And the same thing can happen in the gigs and the cocktail bars you may play or wherever it is. So it's good to learn how to make people's heads turn.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's interesting because it's kind of like it's like a live version of what happens on social media.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do something to make people take notice in a sea of like content they've got flying at them. It's exactly the same when they're walking down the high street and there's a million and one things to look at. You've got to make, you know, you, as cool as it is to sit there and just kind of jam on an E chord or whatever, you've got to do something different. Otherwise you just, you're not going to get their attention.
Yeah.
And I guess you guys must have felt that with the heart-shaped box video and stuff, because, you know, TikTok is a huge revenue for musicians now.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was a wild thing to see happen. And yeah, so we were like, oh, this actually works. The algorithm didn't punish us. Let's see if we can give it something else. And we did Nothing Else Matters by Metallica after that.
Mm-hmm.
And Metallica were kind enough to repost it, which was very helpful. And yeah, it was another thing where it got traction, I guess, because Metallica were tagged. They were seeing the notification come up. But again, we were like, how can we make this different to the average cover? Not just blues it up with slide guitar and, you know, Americana instruments, but, you know, we put on some weird masks and got some weird lights out and we're wearing some weird outfits and, you know, just giving people something different, hopefully.
Do you think in that sense, being an artist has like changed in the last 50 years?
Absolutely.
You've got to, like, it's not just the music, it's not just the song, it's the whole thing.
Yeah, definitely. It's a visual thing now more than ever, I think. I don't know, because you teach as well, right?
Yeah.
I find that with my younger students, sort of like 20 and under, they don't seem to form an opinion about what music they like. And I suspect this is because the algorithm of Reels or TikTok or whatever it may be is providing that for them. And, you know, if you get a catchy Reel song, then maybe they're more familiar with it or lesser than others. But, you know, I've not had a student under the age of 15 say, here's a song I really want to learn.
Mm.
But maybe I'm just not getting the right students. Who knows?
No, I think that's absolutely true. I think one of the interesting, I've seen this observation before, but I really felt it because I've been teaching for quite a long time now.
Mm.
I used to have students come in with, you know, there's an album that they love and they come in and go, I really want to learn track 8.
and it's, you know, it's some, not a single, it's just an album track, and it's like, oh, okay, cool. And then, you know, in the early days of not streaming but downloading, you know, kind of LimeWire days, then what you got was students would come in with like a CD with writing all over it, which was just a bunch of singles. They made their own kind of compilations.
Yes.
That was oh, okay, cool. Now they want to learn that. And, you know, the latest thing is now they just want to learn whatever single is pushed to them, you know, via TikTok or via their Spotify or via the things you might like on Apple Music, whatever it is. So I think the ownership of music in a way is kind of, I think maybe it's just moved up. You know, you get there when you're older now, whereas it used to be, you know, when we were like, I don't know how old you are, but similar age to me, you know, when we were sort of 13, 14, 15, like most of my identity was wrapped up in what music I listened to.
Oh, yeah.
You know, everything, the whole, it influenced how I dressed, you know, what car I wanted to buy, you know, literally everything. Mm-hmm. And now I don't think that's the case.
No, I don't think so either. It's a strange time. It's a strange time to be trying to sell music. Mm. And I don't think it should be the primary of objective of a musician now. Before it was, you know, sell a million records. Oh, my God. But now, maybe not.
I think one thing I heard that I thought was interesting was that it was someone talking about the way that music used to be before the kind of CD revolution, or before vinyl, really. Like before, in the sort of 40s, 50s, early 60s, bands made most of their money playing live. Yeah. And then it was only once they started mass producing music that that became the commodity. And then playing live just became a way of selling it. But now it's kind of flipped back. Whereas it's like, you know, they release an album to give them a reason to go on tour. And that's where they make money. Because I don't imagine, like, you know, your average band that, let's say, I don't know, would sell 5,000 records. You know, they're not making any money anymore. You know, the bands that are selling 5 billion, you know, they're still making money, but, you know, it's kind of cut off that lower tier and just made it a purely kind of, I don't know, a more kind of live-based thing, or you know, placements are a big thing if you can get onto the right playlists and TikTok reels and, you know, TV and movies, of course. But it's interesting because it's changed, and it's changed in a way that I don't think any other industry has. You know, ebooks have never replaced bookshops. But you're hard pressed to find a CD or vinyl store really that isn't either very specialist or, you know, like HMV, which is full of t-shirts.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I find the record shops that are around, they're crazy expensive. I don't know if it's inflation and that's how much records cost. I wasn't really around for, you know, records. I'm 23 years old. So, you know, but I do think, like, I look at some records and they're like 35 quid. Yeah. And I don't know if that's the equivalent of what it would set you back in perhaps the 80s or the 70s.
Yeah, I think there's no way. I think it's become a lot more niche, and the people buying them are people that also have money.
Yeah, 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 absolutely.
Yeah, and it's not a 13-year-old anymore. It's a 50-plus, you know. And it's become a bit of a, I don't know, it's a bit like, you know, it's almost like buying... it's sort of seen as a high quality thing, you know, like people who have like home cinemas, they still buy Blu-ray and stuff like that. Yeah, it's kind of seen like that, you know. Whereas you can kind of rent all the music you ever want on Spotify for $5 a month or whatever it is. It's a crazy thing. So you're 23. You're younger than I thought you were. No offense.
That's okay. That's okay.
Are you're sick. You look like shit. No, I'm kidding. So talk to me about how you got into playing guitar, and particularly how you got into playing banjo.
Oh man. So with guitar, we had a family friend, still do. We have a family friend who suffers from muscular dystrophy. And you know, I've only ever known him to be paralyzed from the neck down, but one day there was an event going on and there was an acoustic duo playing covers there, and kind of just kept staring at the guitar player, and in the breaks I'd say to the guitar player, just asking, I don't remember what questions, I was 7, but kind of just asking, oh, can I try it? And, you know, just making noise. So he comes up to me and he says, well, look, I have a guitar I got to grade 8 on and I played it all my life until I couldn't. You can have the guitar if you promise to learn it. So I said, yeah, I'll do that. In fact, here it is. It's weird, man. It's a weird guitar. But it's an Epiphone.
Okay.
Yes, but it's like a junior. It's got no pickguard, one pickup, wraparound tail bridge. It's tiny. And then my guitar teacher that I eventually got said, this, the truss rod's broken in it. This is firewood. And I said, no, I'm going to keep it, man. And what I did, I put a thingy on it. So it's
like a lap steel. Crazy high.
Yeah. So it's basically my lap steel now for when I feel like doing some C6 tuning stuff. But yeah, that was pretty much guitar. And then with banjo, again, similar situation. A family friend gave us a banjo after I'd been playing guitar for like 5 years. And I kind of fooled around on it before I realized, oh, open G is really confusing. And it collected dust. But then I got into slide guitar and I was like, oh, yeah, this sort of makes sense with open G. Mm. I kind of saw banjo and open G tuning on guitar very similar. Mm. So I picked up banjo a bit. But I would never dare call myself a banjo player. I just can fool around on it. And that's what I did on Heart Shape Box. Because KK Hammond tunes to really strange places, like open B, or like, you know, she goes to what is essentially D tuning, but then goes low, low, low to B. So with the banjo, I had to just tune until I could find a chord somewhere and then move that around. And
oh, okay, I'm with you.
Yeah. It was a weird one. But yeah, that's sort of my story with guitar and banjo. Yeah.
So what kind of stuff did you start off playing? Was it like classic kind of, you know, starting off with classic rock stuff, AC/DC? Was it all that? Or were you straight into blues?
So if I'm being 100% honest, I had the guitar a while before I really got the teacher and all that. But what triggered me to really want to learn the guitar I had acquired. Did you ever have Guitar Hero on Nintendo DS?
Yeah.
So on one of the levels, like the last one, Stevie Ray Vaughan's Pride and Joy's on there. And like, I'd gone through the whole game and I was like, okay, cool. And I'd look up the songs, download them, rip them to MP3, or whatever I did when I was 11. But yeah, Pride and Joy was on there. I was like, oh, now this is something, this has like a groove, and but it also has that familiarity of it being a blues song to an 11-year-old. It's familiar. So yeah, I just went on the YouTube thing and I was like, God, I have to try this. I have to try and learn this style if I am going to learn at all. And yeah, so I really did kind of start on blues, but it took me a while to find a teacher that would explain what the 12 bar changes are. And
yeah.
You know, but I just start off by going Hideaway, that's a song. Pride and Joy, that's a song, without never making the connection of being a 12 bar until someone properly explained that to me. But now I hear those chord changes everywhere all the time. It's ruined music for me.
Do you know what? It's funny. I had, I'm obviously a little bit older than you, but I had the opposite experience with Guitar Hero. I think Guitar Hero came out when I was older. And I remember by then I could already play guitar, but I couldn't play Guitar Hero. And I used to find it so frustrating because it was like, I felt like I had to play very slightly out of time to make it.
Yeah, work. Man. When you go back to it now.
Yeah. It used to really annoy me. And then I think they brought out one that was like for a real guitar, Rocksmith. You ever try that one?
I did. Yeah. I got it the Christmas it came out. I remember. Came with a weird USB to instrument cable. And it was strange.
I'm amazed that didn't take off more.
I know. Yeah.
Yeah.
They released a second game, I think. But yeah, I just remember there not being enough blues on there. A common theme in this genre, man, misrepresentation everywhere in music. People don't talk about blues enough.
Absolutely. Well, look at us here.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. So what kind of, when did you make the transition from like playing to, what's the word? Kind of taking it seriously. Like when you start playing with other people, playing shows, what about your first show?
I'm just interrupting this episode to let you know about the Blues Guitar Show Plus membership. Plus members get access to weekly lessons each Friday, complete with tabs and downloads. For just $5 a month, you'll get instant access to nearly a year's worth of guitar lessons covering finger picking, fretboard theory, soloing, improvising, slide, and much, much more. If you're tired of bouncing around on YouTube trying to pick up bits of information from here and from there, and you find it hard to commit to regular lessons, this is for you. Details of how to join are in the description below. Now back to the episode.
My first show, I wouldn't call it a serious show. At the time, it was serious to me, but I was 13 and it was my dad's wedding.
Oh, wow.
His second marriage. And yeah, that night was also my first time consuming alcohol. They were bringing around Kia Royales, and I thought it was Ribena or something. So I was like, and then I got up and played Smells Like Teen Spirit to an iPod backing track to friends and family. But my first like gig, you know, getting out there and playing for people with friends as a band was at the Horn with a band called Igneous Frog. And, you know, when you're like 16, you're getting out of that phase where it's like, oh, I like this music, I like that music, but this is what I want to do. And that was the case for me anyway. So we did a 25-minute set consisting of Weezer, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Jimi Hendrix, Nirvana, and Blink 182, of course. And like, I feel like a lot of people go down that route. But yeah, that was my first proper gig, you know, getting paid for it, selling tickets, playing to people. We played to about 120 people that night, and it will always be one of my more memorable gigs, I think, anyway.
That's a pretty good first gig turnout. I mean, my first gig, I played in a bar a couple of hours outside Paris with my brother. I think it was 11 or 12. And it was to the barman, a couple of old dudes from the village, and my dad.
No, I would do the odd school fete or whatever with the school choir. They put me on ukulele or double bass. But yeah, in terms of like, and it started to feel a bit more real. Yeah, it was then. And I was in a transitional period where I was like 16. I'd left school. I started going to college in London at ICMP. And I'd left school, had those friends. And then I also started hanging out with the other musos in St. Albans. And St. Albans has a wonderful, wonderful music scene. So I had those three groups. I said, hey, buy a ticket to all three groups of them. So it turned out for a nice, what's the word, turnout.
So you went to ICMP?
I did, yeah. I did 2 years access to music there, which is a college course. Sorry?
In Kilburn?
Yeah, yeah. And then I did uni there. Yeah.
Oh, great. So for all the Americans listening, ICMP is like a music university. It's a little bit like Berkeley. I'd done a few lectures there. I did, I went and lectured there this year and last year about making a career in the music industry.
Hilarious. Oh, wow. I remember those.
Yeah, I was one of those guys.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's cool. Yeah, it's a really cool place. They've got some great studios there.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, cool. So what about getting into slide guitar? Because for me, I always admire slide players. I mean, yourself, Rich, who I know that you know, and KK Hammond. Like, I think at the moment it's really cool because I feel like, I don't know if this is just like the Instagram bubble I've got into, but it feels like there's loads of great slide players at the moment, which is really awesome. And it's something that my background is, my first instrument was bass, and then I took up guitar a little bit later. But slide guitar I took up even later than that. And I think it was because I had this kind of mental block about it that I think a lot of guys that I work with also have, where you can play guitar but you pick up a slide and suddenly you can't play guitar. and it is a hurdle, and you've got to kind of relearn some things. So what was your transition into slide playing like?
I was lucky. I was really, really lucky. I remember my first guitar teacher, I said, hey, I've heard this guy called I've heard Eric Clapton's acoustic unplugged album. He does Walking Blues. Can you teach it to me? And he said, you're not ready for it. And I said, okay. And for similar things like this, I changed teachers, or I just stopped going to. And when I got to music GCSE, they gave us a guitar teacher. And I thought, okay, here's my chance. And this was like a year on. So instead of this time saying Eric Clapton, I'd obviously done my homework. And I went up to him and said, hey, I heard this guy on a blues compilation called Bucca White. And he's a slide player. He plays one of those metal guitars, those tin guitars, I probably said. He'd teach me. And he said, okay, sure. And like, you know, he was just receptive to anything I wanted to learn. He'd, even if he had to break it down into smaller steps, he was still more than happy to, you know, just take me through it. And yeah, that was when I was like 16. So he showed me open tuning. The way he explained it was, understand how open tuning sort of translates from standard tuning. So you kind of have an E chord, you kind of have the top two pentatonic strings, then apply the slide and get your slide technique. And that's not going to happen for another 2 weeks, Casper. You got to show me you can do this, this, this first. And I said, okay. And then after that, we'll look at finger picking. And we never did. but yeah, that's sort of how I got into it. And I just kept at it, man. Like, I became obsessed with as I say, Bucker White, Charlie Patton, who else? Robert Johnson, of course, Sunhouse. Delta Blues guys, I was just like a complete nerd for them. And then something magical happened. I opened Instagram one day, and were you following him when his username was Charlie Hicks?
David
and the Devil.
David and the Devil. Oh, he's such a great player.
In it, dude. I got really lucky, and he puts on his Instagram, St. Albans, here I come. This is like 2018. And I said, oh, are you doing a gig or something? He said, no, I'm moving. And I was like, oh my God, that's my town. And so I'd go over to his house when I was like 18, and he showed me like my first few like meme licks, you know, not just the 12 fret Elmore James, but he'd show me my first few stuff and just show me some chord voicings and stuff. And yeah, the first time I ever met him, out of like the five times I've met him in total, the first time was my first ever gig with my blues band, with the Swamp Dogs. He joined us on stage for like Texas Flood. He brought his Mulecaster with him. And yeah, I remember that very well.
That's awesome.
But yeah, he showed me a couple licks. And
that's really cool, man. Yeah, I've seen he stopped doing music for a little while, but then he kind of seemed to have started up again, which is really great to see.
Yes.
And, he's been given some badass looking green mule. Have you seen it?
Dude, yeah. Yeah. When I saw that, I was like, oh man.
But yeah, no, he's a great player. If anyone hasn't listened to Charlie Hicks or the David and the Devil records, they're great. He's got an awesome voice as well. Like, yeah. I cover one of his songs quite often when I'm playing live stuff, which is the Don't Rain on Me.
Oh yeah, man. Yeah.
It's just such a good kind of droning, open tuning song. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really cool. So your band, the Swamp Dogs,
yes.
You guys are doing quite a lot of gigging.
If you love good music and good podcasts, you'll love Roots Music Rambler. I'm Jason Falls. My co-host Francesca Folinazzo and I talk to the singers, songwriters, musicians, and more in Americana, alt-country, bluegrass, folk, blues, and beyond. We share our own takes on the latest news in the space and recommend new music for you to explore every episode. Come get to the roots of the music you love. Find us at RootsMusicRambler.com or go wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to Roots Music Rambler.
Yeah, I actually, as it happens, I did a count up last night because I kind of looked at what gigs I've got in for December and I thought I'd count. And between like my solo gigs and band gigs and, you know, whatever else I've done, I've done 100 gigs this year, which I'm really happy with. It's a big jump from last year. And but yeah, with Swamp Dogs as well, like we had a crazy summer together. We had one day, we did 3 gigs as a band in one day. 1 p.m. we're in Harpenden, 4 p.m. we're in Hemel Hempstead, and then 11 p.m. we're in Camden.
Where in Camden were you playing?
Spiritual Records.
Oh, okay, Spiritual Records, nice.
Yeah, yeah.
I've only done that a couple of times. I did once where I had 2 gigs in one night, but with 2 different bands.
Yeah.
And they were both in Camden. So I thought this is totally doable. It's absolutely fine. And then I don't know how well you know Camden, but one of the gigs was at the Underworld and the other one was at the Unicorn, which you know what the Unicorn is. It's like they're both Camden, but they're really not.
You know? Nah, it's like Kentish Town, isn't it? Yeah.
It's a long way. And I was like, oh, damn. And this was like pre Uber days.
Mm-hmm.
Just find a taxi. But that's cool. That's awesome.
Yeah, we've just been trucking along, man. We've been, we recorded some singles with Spiritual as well. We did that in summer, which is really nice because we hadn't been recording together since 2021.
And is that the record that you've got out already?
No. This is going to be out in January. Well, we're going to drip feed some singles. Mm-hmm. And the first one's out on January 12th through Spiritual Records as a label. And it's been really fun just to be in a proper studio together again. And I say proper because we have a CD that's out, but we recorded that in Mia, our drummer, we recorded that in her uni accommodation in the kitchen. So it's boomy, it's loud, and it's a bit strange sounding, but I liked some of the songs on there for sure. But it's nice to be somewhere where we've had a producer, someone to kind of hold our hands through the process, and song with the confidence as well to know, oh, this is where this microphone needs to go, and you know, and but also someone who appreciates the music we're doing. It sounds like my reference tracks was like Muddy Waters, Hard Again. Obviously, my favorite, Live at the Fillmore, mm-hmm. Allman Brothers, and like probably Albert King Live at the Fillmore or something. And I don't remember exactly what I sent through. But I wanted the live feel. I didn't want it crystal clean or anything. This is like slide guitar, Delta blues. I'm screaming as I sing. And, you know, I wanted to give it that old sound without tarnishing the standards of today's production quality.
How much do you have to consider, like how things are going to be released when you're planning them? I mean, like, because, you know, you obviously look to record a record, but you don't just release stuff as a record anymore. You kind of, like you say, drip feed stuff. How much do you have to consider, and how early on in the process do you think about that stuff?
It's an overwhelming amount. My goal this year, as the year turned, was to release music and not gig so much, but the complete opposite happened. So I'm reverting to next year for that happening. But yeah, I mean, and this is going to be like an ICMP thing, but they went into great detail about releasing music, and they explained, yeah, we now live in the age of the playlist. Forget doing an album. Even if you record an album, you should release the playlist, because the Spotify algorithm's a hungry beast and wants more songs, or generally wants more releases. Mm. If you can do 4 albums in a year, the algorithm's not going to care. Mm. It wants the releases, not necessarily album singles. But therefore, with my deal with Spiritual, I've done 4 songs, and I will release 4 songs spread out at an even rate. I mean, yeah, without trying to pull up the curtain or the fourth wall, whatever it is for your listeners, I've considered so much. And I've learned a ridiculous amount from KK Hammond. And, you know, she is just like, I don't know, she's like an encyclopedia for this kind of thing. So, you know, spending time with her and learning to release a song alongside her, and watching her release her album as well, taught me so much. And yeah, she's been a real mentor in that sense.
But it's amazing how much that's changed in the industry. You know, this is stuff that musicians never used to have to think about. You know, they would just make music. Somebody else would just deal with that stuff. So yeah, it's really interesting to me. I also feel like, when I was playing in bands, we always went down the album route. We always released albums, and the bands I was playing and we sort of went down the very niche route where you flip it on its head and you release an album, but you only release it on tape, you know, that kind of stuff, which is kind of, it's another avenue to go. And it's actually, you know, it can be a fairly lucrative option, because you hit the right kind of target market that are interested in tape and vinyl and stuff like that. Then, you know, they also want a full album. But I always wonder whether or not our music would have been collectively better if you'd considered every song as a single, whether you get rid of some of the chaff and you end up with just the, you know, just the kind of cream of the crop, if you like.
Yeah. It is an interesting one. I don't know. I had to I probably wrote 10 songs before whittling it down to these 4. And one of them is my own version of This Train, which is a traditional gospel song anyway. Mm. Although no one knows that yet, so you're hearing that for the first time. there's the 4-4. So, you know, I even wrote some songs and I didn't even choose them. I just felt, and with the advice from producer Jack Trouble, he said like, yeah, maybe this one or that one. And he helped me write as well. And, you know, I took full advantage of the position I was in being with Spiritual. But yeah, it's a good point. I think it was Ed Sheeran that said he wrote like 100 songs to pick the 9 for his album. I can't remember which album or where I read that or which teacher told me that, but
yeah,
that's in my brain somewhere. And I kept that in my brain for when I came to this process.
Yeah. Cause I feel like a lot of bands certainly did. Don't know if they still do, but may well still do, write 10 songs and go, oh, we've got an album. Let's put those 10 songs out.
Like, I bet some do.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. And I think actually some quite established bands, you know, you used to be able to quite clearly pick out album tracks and go, oh, this is a filler track.
Yeah.
And I feel like that might have fallen by the wayside, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. That might be a good thing. Mm. You mentioned that you guys did a mix at Abbey Road. Did you go there to hear it sitting on the mix?
Yes. Yeah. We were in Studio 3, I think. You got one, that's the orchestral room. You got two, that's the Beatle room. And then three was the same room. Pun?
The KK Hammond room.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And Dark Side of the Moon.
Amazing.
Yeah, we got to mix in there and like we were in there mixing. It was a Saturday, I think. And yeah, producer man said, "Oh, we could beef up this percussion." I'm like, "Oh, how?" And he said, "Oh, we'll kick a table. I'll set up some mics." And so yeah, we got there and there was a table which we stood on with seven very expensive microphones pointing at it. And we just kicked it, stomped on it for a while, and that created the percussion for Heartshaped Box. And I was kind of looking like, I was like, wow, we're in Abbey Road. And I think like, oh, Pink Floyd and Radiohead, this, that, the other. And then you kind of have to look at yourself kicking a table and thinking, this is like, this is where you're at. And then, you know, you can have this, you know, this sort of felt like, yeah. But yeah, it was so fun to go there. And I'm, my first like musical memories are Beatles albums. And yeah, I saw you got your Hofner as well.
Yes, I do, right behind me.
Yeah, man.
We picked that up yesterday.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a new one. I've got this ridiculous, you can see behind me that I've got like
a tree. Christmas
tree of guitars. Yeah, it's actually, I was working in a guitar store and it closed down and they had just a storage unit full of stuff. Mm. And this was a display for guitars and it basically holds seven instruments sort of in a display. And they just went, oh, you can take it. And I was like, oh, awesome. So yeah, I've got the guitar tree. Man,
the way I have my guitars right now is pretty disgusting. I think I'm cramming like seven or eight up here on a stand for five. Not good. I'm in a very small space right now.
Yeah. Actually, I have guitars that don't fit on the stand. I've got some over here. I mean, it's just, it is a lot. How many have you got? What's your collection? Oh, like? God.
I picked one up on Saturday. there is one, two. I think it's around 14 or 15.
That's pretty substantial.
Yeah. There's two in the wardrobe. and I think someone's borrowing one. So it's more around 17, I think. It's too many. I'm trying to sell my 12 string.
What was the one I saw you playing the other day on Instagram with the crosses on the fretboard?
This one.
What is that? That looks awesome. It's an arch top kind of.
Yeah, it's a 1950s Hofner. Which someone sort of refinished the neck and put these crosses in. And it's also like a, I don't know how well the camera can pick it up, but it's like a faux snakeskin.
Oh, wow.
I bought it for a girlfriend I used to have off David and the Devil. And then...
Well, that was his.
Yes. And then I bought it off her last Saturday. But oh, it's cool, man. I liked plugged in. It's great. But also you get that sort of weird Fred McDowell acoustic sound. You always see Fred McDowell with an arch top, but on YouTube he's always playing an electric, I think. Yeah. So I was like, oh yeah, it's that sort of thing. And it's got so much sustain, I think, because you got these weird bits down here and they do
behind the bridge.
Yeah, yeah. And the I don't know what you call them. The tailpiece is strange. It's like all these long individual bits of metal. So vibrate.
Yeah, so it almost looks like a, what's one of those little, a kalimba? You know, those little percussion instruments.
It's so weird.
Crazy noise.
Yeah, but it's great.
Is it a sort of natural distortion?
Yeah, literally, yeah. But yeah, I keep it in open D at the moment. But I've only had it for a couple of days.
That sounds so awesome. That's really cool. It looks a lot like one of the ones that Reverend Peyton plays. He plays a few of those old Hofners.
He does. Yeah. But I'm hoping to use it on stage because it sounds super similar to the Mule in some ways. The pickup is really microphonic,
right,
which is a problem. And other ways it's not. But with that big hollow guitar and a stinky pickup on it, it's like it sounds so similar to the Mule. So I'm thinking maybe like a backup or...
Yeah,
E-tuning, G-tuning, I don't know. We'll see.
So what is your main setup when you go playing shows like band shows versus solo shows? What do you take?
I like to mix it up, but the Mule always comes with me for the band shows without no question about it. My Mule Tricone. And I'll bring a guitar for standard tuning. And that this year, I guess, has been this Les Paul I've got here. I can show you. It needs a new string. but it's, I don't know. It could be fake. We don't know. We made a YouTube video about it. But it's could be a 1969 gold top. Or it could be like firewood.
Chipson.
Yeah, exactly. I have no idea. The pickups say PAF, but they're definitely not. I had my man, Kersey, Matt Kersey from Kersey Guitars, look at it, and he said, yeah, I don't know. I just want to make a playing guitar. And I said, okay, let's document it. And we made a YouTube video.
Some of those, I used to live in China, and I ordered online. It was just one of those like, oh, let's just see what it's like. Mm. I ordered a Fender Strat, that was, I think it was, let me try and do the conversion. I think it was about £60, you know, about $80, $100, nothing.
Yeah.
And it came and I was like, this is pretty good. Like,
I don't know
if I'd be able to tell, like, if somebody, because I for one part, like, the evil part in my brain thought, if I could buy 100 of these and ship them to the UK, you know.
That's what happens, man.
They're pretty good. And I had Squires, and I'm kind of going, it's like a Squire. Mm. They're quite impressive. And they're getting harder and harder to spot, I think.
Yeah, that's the thing, though. If it plays good and you like it, then that should be what matters.
Yeah,
Slash's guitar from Appetite for Destruction wasn't a real one, wasn't it?
Mm.
But yeah, I found it a little difficult to play sometimes, but I think that's because it might actually be old. Like, right. just doing bends, I'm really, really working. But then later on in the year, Matt Kersey, who got that Les Paul going, because it was like in a horrible state. He was like, why did you buy this? He said, hey, I got this guitar. Can you bring it round and like play it at your show so people can see the guitars I build? And I said, yeah, of course. I don't have it with me. He's got it back for some photos. But so that's his Kersey Sequoia model. And that's a very nice guitar. It's very light and got a nice neck through body.
Is that a Les Paul style one? Or is that a Tele?
It's his own thing. It's sort of like a sort of like a non-reverse Firebird, but a bit more Fendery, I guess.
Oh, cool.
So a little more compact, a little less chunky, light.
What's the electric that you play in the Heart-Shaped Box video?
That is KK Hammond's Mulecaster.
Cool. Okay, cool. Yeah, I was looking at that thinking that thing looks awesome. So that's kind of a Telecaster shape.
Yeah, and I recorded the solo on that guitar as well, which is really fun. I keep joking that she's going to sell it to me, but I don't think she ever will. she sold me the Tricone.
Okay, cool.
I didn't buy that straight from Mule. I bought that off KK Hammond.
I love the great guitar continuum. Like, when I had Martin Roper and Rich on, they were talking about most of his guitars from Martin. He's got them from, you know, Jack at Diamond Guitar, you know, Diamond Slides.
Down yeah, man. Yeah.
You know, they're just kind of, there's just this like whirlwind of resonators going around the UK.
Yeah, same with this Hofner, man. This Hofner, which I showed you earlier, I think David bought it and sold it like a good few times, as he does sometimes with his guitars. But I've got it now.
Amazing.
This 12 string which I'm selling was KK Hammond's for about a week.
So what's the 12 string? What is that?
It's gross. That's what it is. I said, oh yes, cheap 12 string, I'll buy it off you. It's called a Statesboro. So it's supposed to be like a Blind Willie McTell Stella copy, but it's unplayable. Right. It has got a cool story, though. It's got a J stamped into it, and that is something to do with just trying to put this back carefully. That is something to do with it being repossessed. So the shop must have gone under. It was repossessed, and then the repossession people stamped a J into it, and I can't remember why do that. But yeah, that's why it was cheap. And it's just been in a basement, so... I mean, it plays really good. You should really buy it off me.
Yeah, you're selling it brilliantly.
Yeah, man. but yeah, to answer your question, I nowadays I take out the Kersey to play standard tuning. the mule for anything slide, so open D or G. And then amps, I use a Blues Junior, which someone converted into a head in Barcelona. So I have to use a English to European adapter to use it anywhere. We were on tour and we got to Manchester, and somewhere along the way I lost my power adapter. And I went in a shop and I said, hey, I really need one of these. And he said, yeah. I bought like five of them. I never wanted that to happen again. And then he said, hey, do you also want some like really cheap cigarettes? I was like, yeah.
I love Manchester.
Yeah, man. And then, I've downsized my pedal board recently as well, because I had the biggest one you could possibly buy, because I thought, oh, then like I can buy all the pedals I want. But I never ended up buying the pedals and it just became a pain. So yeah. I bought a smaller pedal board, and yeah, that's pretty much it, dude.
Amazing.
I like my Sheraton as well. I got an Epiphone Sheraton. That's one of my favorite guitars, really. I've had it for such a long time. And if I'm not feeling the Les Paul or the Sequoia and I want something familiar, I'll take out the Sheraton.
Yeah. So what about when you're writing? Like, do you have a kind of go-to guitar or tuning, or do you just kind of pick it up and see what comes? How does the process look for you?
Some guitars I have written their own songs. Like the Mule has been probably like the biggest inspiration for writing songs. I wrote most songs I wrote on that was for a rock band I used to have. When I'm writing like the blues stuff, I don't really want to think about, ooh, shiny guitar with F holes and it's made of steel. I pick up a wood body acoustic. And that, I don't know why, whether it's just because it's the guitar that's usually sat here at my desk and I can just go, oh, lyric, and start playing. Because the Mule lives downstairs. When I'm ready to go gig, I just grab it and go. The National as well. The National I've had for such a long time. And I like to write songs on that as well. Although sometimes they just come from jams me and the band will have. If we've booked out a rehearsal space, it's half an hour to kill. We just start jamming. And songs will come together like that. But most songs start with lyrics. And I start thinking, will this fit in a 12 bar? And then I'll pick up whatever guitar's nearby. The Mule's really good at writing alternative country rock, apparently, as was the case with my old band.
That sounds cool. So when you kind of write lyrics, do you sit down to write lyrics, or do lyrics kind of come to you and you think, oh, I better write that down so I don't forget it?
I find that whenever I've sat down to write lyrics, I don't know, man. You kind of think about it too much and you go, oh, yeah, this is good. And then you wake up the next day and like, that's cheesy. I like to write lyrics when you've been on the tube or driving or whatever, and something comes to your mind. Like, I don't know. Let's see. Let's have a quick look. Since I'm at my computer, let's see if anything recently has come to my mind.
It's a kind of world I know nothing about, weirdly, because I think I've never really written lyrics, and all the music that I release is instrumental. So it's something that I can't really fathom how you sit down and just start going, okay, I'm going to write some lyrics.
Yeah. It usually just comes to me. I think, this one, I know what happened. I was upset with someone I know that day. And the line, it's just a note from October 3rd, 2023. It says, I've worn out the snooze button, getting tired of you.
It's good.
That might be a song. I don't know. I often consult Ian, my bass player, for lyrics. We got one coming out, it's not coming out, sorry. It's one we want to finish writing. Me and Ian are really happy with it, but Mia's not sure about it. It's called Gamer Girl Gumbo, because we came home from a weekend of gigging, and Ian's girlfriend was like, oh, you're going off gigging again. Okay, I'm going to have a girls' weekend and hire a hot tub. And so by the time we got back from the gigging, they'd had the weekend. We got back on the Sunday evening. So there was still a bit of hot tub time left for me and Ian. We get in, and the water was like kind of green and smelly. From when, so I've, and like, I don't know, Ian's girlfriend, she's really sweet. I love her, but yeah, they're all like gamer girls. So I thought, oh, yeah, her and her friends. I thought, oh, yes, the gamer girl gumbo. But I'm waiting for approval from Mia, being the only female in the group. Got to kind of,
I'm amazed that you can hire a hot tub. That's incredible.
You can, man. It's like 150 quid for the weekend.
Really?
But yeah, just like, if it calls for it, you kind of feel it like, oh, I should write that down. That's actually kind of good. But most of my lyrics are based off of things that have happened to me. And I just find myself in stupid situations, man. I don't know. Probably stuff I can't talk about on the podcast. I don't want you to get demonetized or something. But like Jersey Farm Blues is one I love to sing because it's so easy to explain the story. You know, when you go to a gig and someone's explaining the story and you start doing that, looking at your watch.
Yeah.
For me, I say, who's from St. Albans? And some people go, or no one does. It doesn't matter. And then I say, oh yeah, well, this song's about getting robbed in St. Albans. We were too young to, and so on. Or like, I have a song about my old pet parrot. And I start saying, this song is a blues song about a woman. And people go, oh. I say, it's a woman we used to keep in a cage. and then you resolve it with, but it's a pet parrot. And everyone goes, okay. Oh, that's funny. That's very good. Or whatever they should say after hearing that. I say this a lot. And, you know, being, you know, I don't come from poverty. I don't come from, I don't know, I'm not really a minority of some kind, and I'm not really, I'm not going to sing about something I haven't experienced.
Yeah.
You know, and I see people try and do that, and I think it's questionable when people sing perhaps about being from Mississippi when they're not.
Yeah.
Or something of the type. So I take the lyric writing to an extreme like that. Just because that's my experience and I can make a fun story out of that.
Well, and it makes it honest and unique. And
yeah,
I mean, I could write you the lyrics to a typical blues song right now, you know, and anybody can do that. And that's kind of not interesting.
We've got that so much at the moment as well. Songs about guitars, man. I don't know about you, but I'm really bored of songs about guitars.
I can't think of any songs about guitars. Although Buddy Guy did one, right? I think Buddy Guy might have done one.
He might have, yeah. I see it so much at the moment as well. And I want to try and stand out is what I'm getting to. If you want to write a song about your guitar, whoever's listening, do it. But, you know, I think writing from personal experience gives you the most unique contribution to not just blues, but music generally.
And, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Sharing stories and sharing love as well.
How does it work with the band? Like, is it you write all the stuff or do you write the stuff together? You mentioned that you jam a lot of the stuff.
Yeah. I mean, often I'll sit in my room and I'll either come up with a riff. I came up with a spooky one the other day, actually. I think it was in minor tuning. Something like that. And then I'll open up Logic, maybe, if I feel like I have the time. I'll open up Logic, pull up the drummer, and kind of send something through. Or I'll just send a voice note in a really raw form to our group chat. And then Ian will say, hey, can we hang out next week and do that? And I said, yeah. It's not so easy for Mia because she lives in Manchester. But the next time we all get together, me and Ian will have done our homework, and Mia can kind of sit in and start finding her space to sit in on that song. And yeah, that's sort of how it comes together usually.
Yeah, I mean, Logic is amazing for that, isn't it?
Yeah,
man. Tell people, if you want to get into writing any music, just you need to get Logic, because not only have you got access to any potential instruments in you can think of, but also like being able to, like you said, just pull up a drummer, like a drummer track. You can program the drums in if you want, but you can just pull up a drummer track and then you can set the amount of swing that you want and just go. And, you know, then you can send it to a drummer and they can go, oh, that's what you mean.
Yeah.
Whereas before it would be like a lot of conversations around, no, not really like that. And a little bit more, you know, I think Logic's incredible for that. It's like a sort of musical sketch pad.
Yeah, man. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It's a wonderful tool. So efficient as well. And like, I think it intimidates people at first, especially if you're coming from GarageBand, because GarageBand does spoon feed a bit. But once you know it, man, it's like, pow, 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 pow. Learn your shortcuts, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I do everything on Logic, have done for years. But yeah, I find it's the most useful thing. I mean, even when I do like online, I do some session work where I record bass lines and guitar solos or whatever and send them to people for their stuff. I just do it all through Logic. It's so easy. They send me stuff, I drag it in, play along with it, send my stuff back, and it's like, you know, it matches it all to the same tempo. It's definitely worth having. So what have you got coming up? What's kind of next for you? So you've had this big release with KK Hammond, which is great. And you're working on some stuff with the band. What's kind of the next year look like?
Yeah, so like my plan is from January 12th, I'll have music constantly flowing out. I'm going to make sure I'm not at a point where music isn't coming out. January 12th is the next single release for me, and that is with Mia on drums and Ian Davidson on bass. That's called The Notion. It's a gritty, slow blues song. And then I don't want to give too much away. I already have, I think, but more will follow for sure. I'm already, you know, we're looking at trying to get more into the blues circuit for the UK. And that's something I've been working really hard for. And I think we're ready for it as well. So we're playing Broadstairs Blues Bash. I think we're about to confirm Tenby Blues Festival for next November.
Great.
And yeah, we're just going to keep recording, man. Like, I made a cryptic post the other day, but I have something very exciting to share with everyone in the, early on in the next year. But everyone can see that when the time's ready. But yeah, it will just mean constant content, music, videos. I mean, it's going to be a wonderful thing, and I can't wait to share it with everyone. But I don't want to give too much away. I don't know when this will be out as well. Do you know when this podcast will be out?
Before Christmas.
Before Christmas, brilliant. Yeah, if you want to come see the Swamp Dogs play.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Give us the list of dates.
We are doing New Year's Eve at Ye Olde Fighting Cocks.
Brilliant.
The place I booked for, of course. So, yeah, we're playing there. We're going to do 3 hours of nonstop blues, soul, fun music, originals, covers you may not have heard before. We're going to go from Stevie Wonder to Blind Blake. It's going to be a weird one, but it'll be fun.
It's a good one. It's been New Year's Eve. Is that in Hillman's, the Ye Olde Fighting Cocks?
Yes, oldest pub in the universe.
Oh, there you
789
go.
AD, and I run all the music there. So
god damn, that's amazing.
But yeah, that's pretty much it for now.
Yeah, that sounds great. And what about kind of plans with your guitar playing? You know, have you got a kind of idea of things that you want to work on and get better at, or incorporate more of, or any kind of genre shifting stuff?
Recently, I've started taking guitar lessons again from a man called Dom Glynn.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've seen his stuff. He's not particularly active online, but you should check him out, man. He's a wonderful, wonderful. I mean, he plays the Mississippi John Hurt stuff like perfectly. Oh, cool. And that's why I wanted him to teach me finger picking. As I said to you earlier, when I was talking about my slide journey, like I did the open tuning, I did the slide, but never got to the finger picking until this summer. So it's mainly working on that, man. I'll explain. Like before, I'd kind of go, in the example, I don't think I'm going to try and sing. Maybe I will. But if it's Jitterbug Swing and I've gone, well, I need the slide for that. But if I've gone, I kind of go, well, come on, you people, come and do the Jitterbug Swing. For example, I can't sing right now because I'm sick. Heads up. That's not how my album sounds. but now, thanks to his lessons and stuff, I can kind of go a bit more. Give it that bounce, you know?
Yeah.
And my aim with the lessons wasn't necessarily to become a good finger picker, but I'd always see him make a room full of people on a Saturday night in Camden dance to country blues stuff. And I said, that's what I want to do. I don't just want to play it to people and go, look at this old song. I want people to understand that this is a form of dance music. It's party music, even though it's 100 years old. So,
yeah, that's cool. So you can tell in that second example, for anyone that might not have heard it perfectly, is that you had a much better grasp of the Travis picking, you know, with the thumb.
Yeah.
You had a lot more of that going on.
Absolutely. Yeah. Whereas before I was a little sloppy, I'd kind of just strum and maybe hit my thumb on the one, maybe not. But now I'm kind of get a go. And it's made a difference, I think. He's helped me out a lot.
Yeah. And I think that's one of those things that, like we were talking about earlier, when you're playing in the street or you're busking, there's a big difference between somebody who's singing and accompanying themselves on guitar and somebody who's doing both.
Yeah.
And it's things like that, you know, that little being able to do that Travis picking bounce makes you kind of go, oh damn, like that sounds complete, rather than that somebody singing who's accompanying themselves a bit with some chords. And actually that's what you mostly get busking, isn't it? You get people who are just playing open cowboy chords and singing in the UK Oasis songs. And Beatles songs, you know, yeah, relentlessly.
Yeah.
At the public. That's awesome, man. I'm super excited for all the stuff that you got coming up.
Thank you.
So looking forward to what you've got coming out next. So January 12th is when you've got the next bit of music coming out, right?
Yes, if all goes to plan.
Excellent.
Yes.
That's really cool, man. And as I say, I will link to the video for Heart-Shaped Box. If anyone who has missed it, anyone that's been living under a rock, you need to make sure you go and watch that. There's an amazing shot of you playing that solo.
Yeah.
Huge bonfire with, what are you wearing? It's like a
red cloak. And like, I don't know. It's a lot like the skull I showed you.
With horns
and the skeletal. Yeah. I got to press the button to ignite that fire. It was remote ignited.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. We didn't kind of light a match or drop a match on it. We inserted some explosive packs in it, hooked to a wire, and then remote control. Boop. And it went. It was amazing.
It's a huge production. How many people did you have working on that video?
Well, KK Hammond directed it. Her friend Mushroom did the drone shots and set up the explosives and lighting, and her friend Justin also helped with that. And yeah, it was all friends coming together. Amazing. The only person like we sort of had to outsource was the crazy Walker guy,
right?
Whose name is Gary.
And he's crazy walking professionally.
Yeah. He's called Spirit Walker UK, and
that's amazing.
He'll do birthday parties or whatever you need for a crazy flowery Spirit Walker. I don't know. But he was the only person we outsourced. But yeah, it was a wild one. Lots and lots of preparation.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then it was our like 10 odd friends who all dressed up in the crazy cloaks and all homies that like are part of the St. Albans music scene mainly. You know, my band members were there as well. And yeah,
that was
awesome. It was really fun.
Awesome, man. Well, really good to chat to you. And we'll have to catch up again next year when you got some more music out, because I'm looking forward to hearing it.
Dude, yes, please. Thanks so much for having me on here, man, as well. Like, ever since I followed you, like, I was like, oh, man, one day I'd like to get on there.
Well, you're welcome, man. Anytime. Yeah, it's great to have you. Are you fully fretboard confident? Do you know where the notes are, how they connect, and how they move up and down the strings? My latest book, The Triad Method, is all about using simple three-note shapes to completely unlock the fretboard. This book is absolutely full of light bulb moments that are going to demystify the neck three notes at a time. I've compiled a huge number of diagrams, shapes, and exercises based on over 10 years of teaching this stuff to make it as simple as possible. Download The Triad Method and see for yourself today. Link is in the description below.